Welcome, thank you for listening to the Nordic Africa podcast, a series of pod conversations about current trends and issues in Africa. I'm Heba Habib, and sitting here next to me is my colleague Henrik Alfredsson, who will introduce today's episode.
West Africa and the Sahel is one of the regions where people are most affected by climate change in the world. Climate change is often seen as a risk multiplier in this region. Because most people live on subsistence farming, extreme changes in weather have an immediate impact on their survival. The Sahel zone is most vulnerable. It lies just underneath the Sahara Desert. With global warming, access to land, water, and pastures is becoming difficult. It creates competition. It is one of the drivers of violent clashes between farmers and herders, for example. Recent research has also shown how diminishing livelihood opportunities caused by shrinking lakes, rising sea levels, and other effects of climate change can spill over to an increase in violent extremism and terrorism. With us here to discuss the links between climate change and security challenges are Angela Mwumba-Selström, Senior Researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute. Welcome.
Thanks, Henrik. Thanks. Very nice to be here.
Thank you. Ngozi Amu, Head of Research and Analysis at the United Nations Office for West Africa and the Sahel, UNOVAS. And also currently a guest researcher here at the Nordic Africa Institute. Welcome, Ngozi.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Let's kickstart with a complicated question of tremendous dimensions. What links are there between climate change and security challenges in West Africa?
Thank you very much for that question. And thanks again for the opportunity to engage today. Just wanted to point it out that I am on sabbatical, and so I'm speaking in my personal capacity for this podcast. And now then to the question about the links between climate change and security challenges in West Africa and the Sahel. First, I think it's important to emphasize that we're not talking about a direct link between climate change and security. This is not about cause and effect. It's much more complicated than that. What climate change does is that it intensifies vulnerabilities of people who are already living on the margins of society. So in West Africa, which is the area that concerns me, those people who are most vulnerable to climate change are people who depend on land, water, and other natural resources for subsistence. So we're talking about the farmers and the herders and the fishermen and the miners and other groups. And these people make up 60 to 70% of the population in West Africa and the Sahel. So it's not a fringe kind of population. It's most of the people living there. And of this category, at least when it comes to farmers, 80% are women. If you count women's activity all the way from the sort of the harvesting and the packaging of the goods and the selling the goods at the market. So climate change is a trigger. We're talking about extreme heat waves, droughts, sandstorms, flooding, ocean warming. So if you are a farmer living in this region and your crop fails, you have no income, it becomes difficult. If you are a fisherman and the fish stock is reduced, it will be difficult to survive. So this can lead to competition. I think competition is a very important word when it comes to this. Competition over resources that are less available. Now, it doesn't mean automatically that this will lead to tensions and conflict, but because people are living already on the brink, it's difficult. So in the UN, we tend to look at these issues in the framework of what we call human security. So human security is anything that has an impact on a person's ability to survive. So whether it's food security, water security, protection, all of these issues. So it's much broader than looking at security in the sense of national security or military security. And then, of course, there are extreme examples when you can see more of a link to actual security. And I think that there have been examples, especially from the Lake Chad region and from the Sahel region, where you can see that young people, you know, who are idle with no work and who have been impacted by in these climatic conditions are more sensitive to being involved in illicit activities. And so there are reports about young people joining armed groups and so on. There are many other factors involved, political factors, economic factors, social factors, historical factors, colonialism, structural factors. So it's sort of a perfect storm of these issues. But what's so worrisome about climate change is when you think about the prognosis that has been given by the Intergovernmental Panel on climate change when it comes to West Africa and the Sahel, because they state that this is the region where the increase in temperature will be more rapid than in other places. So in that sense, climate change is a really essential factor to look at. And there are opportunities to look at this link between climate change and human security in a way that we can prevent a conflict.
So another question here. Over the last decade, the UN Security Council has increasingly begun to consider climate change as part of its peace and security mandate. Yet it remains a contentious issue among council members. Why is that? Maybe Angela first out on that one.
I think there are a couple of things I'd like to say about the role of the Security Council addressing climate change and security and conflict. So first, I want to kind of underscore that the Security Council is quite often working on climate change related aspects in their conflict activities. So in conflict situations where resolutions are passed to address or to give a mandate or to think about how the international community should respond in terms of peace support operations or peace building, the Security Council is actually using its tools in various ways. I think it's something like 70 UN Security Council resolutions have been passed that actually do engage with climate-related issues and the security implications of climate changes or movement of persons because of environmental changes. There have also been a number of presidential statements. And then there are a number of other tools. Those tools can include things like informal meetings and formal meetings. But to your question, it's important to remember that there are member countries on the Security Council that are resistant to using the Security Council as an instrument for addressing climate change. So many analysts will reflect on a resolution that was proposed and voted on in December 2021 that address climate change that was vetoed by Russia. And then I believe India and China abstained in that vote. While that's negative in terms of thinking about formal resolutions that address climate change, it's also very important to remember that 12 other council members did vote for that resolution and that there were, I think, 113 non-members of the council, so governments that weren't sitting in the council, that co-sponsored that resolution. I think when you talk to members of the Security Council, both permanent members and elected members, that many of them will say that they would not stop addressing climate change and climate change issues that affect conflict situations and international peace and security, that this issue is here to stay. So this issue isn't going to go away because a formal resolution that's a thematic resolution hasn't been passed. On the other hand, though, and I tend to think that this is also very important to consider, even there are real reasons why we don't want climate change to just become a securitized issue in the council. We need climate change to be integrated and to be addressed in all manner of instruments of the UN, of organs and agencies of the UN. And I think that some governments are also open to that. And they may not be so keen to have thematic resolutions passed in the council on climate change because they don't, I think it's a kind of funny argument. It's not to say that having these resolutions pass means that nothing is going to be done elsewhere, but it can create a perception that the UN is now doing something. And we see that with other issues like HIV/AIDS as a security issue, or women, peace and security, or children in armed conflict. A lot of media attention, a lot of sort of hubris and language, a lot of even donor support, money follows securitized issues. When actually a lot of important work is taking place outside of those of the peace and security kind of framework of the Security Council. So I think it's not to say that we shouldn't have these thematic resolutions on climate change, but we should also remember that, one, there are many ways that the Security Council can work on climate change by integrating it into its into resolutions, and two, that the Security Council isn't the only forum for addressing climate and security issues.
Can I respond to that?
Of course, please.
I think that's so important what you pointed out, and it's something that I and my colleagues who are working on this in West Africa and the Sahel are also thinking a lot about. We're working on peace building and conflict prevention. Of course, my point of departure will be to look at issues that are related to prevention and peace building. But it doesn't mean that you don't need everyone else on board to look at the economic impact, the impact on the environment, the specific impact on women versus men, and so on and so forth. And so I think that that's an important discussion to be had. At the same time, what the Security Council can do is to elevate issues of importance to a higher level. And I think we've seen in the past when it comes to conflict prevention that it's so difficult to do early prevention, to do prevention, to get it right. And so here's an opportunity with climate change to actually come together and think about the risks involved and try to see what we can do about it from a conflict prevention perspective. So it's not like we're going out looking for conflict and looking to try to see how climate shocks have an impact on conflict. But we can actually right now say, we know the statistics, the forecast by the IPCC. In fact, the last synthesis report of the sixth assessment report that came out in March this year, the main finding there was to say that it's about the next decade. It's not this thing in the long-term future. It's about the next decade. We need to get things right, or else we'll see impacts and disasters of a certain magnitude. So I think in that sense, conflict prevention is essential. And I agree. I think the council has a role as much as the other UN bodies. But we need to elevate the issue and make sure that it is at the highest level of attention.
Follow-up, kind of. Ngozi, you've done research on the links between climate change and peace building, but you're also very engaged in opening up dialogues between science and policy and making it possible for policymakers to be more proactive and informed about climate change. Can you tell us why?
Well, the science-policy nexus is not a new concept, but it's so important. If you don't link research to policy, then you really compromise the impact that you want to achieve. So, of course, it doesn't mean that this dialogue between scientists and policymakers has to happen all the time, but it has to be strategic. Last year in April, we sort of came together, all of us together with some Security Council members, including Ireland and Ghana and Senegal. Senegal is not on the council. And we endorsed the call to action on climate change, peace and security in West Africa and the Sahel. And this call focuses on three main elements: the need for more evidence-based research, the need for more broader and in-depth partnerships on the issue of climate adaptation and peace building. And then third, the need for more financing for climate adaptation. This was one of the key issues, of course, of the last COP27 held in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt last year. But when it comes to partnerships, there is one gap. There's been very little cooperation between our office and our partners in the region, cooperation with the science community, with natural scientists and with social scientists who have an expertise on climate change and ecological issues. And climate change is such a complex science and complex issue. And it's unlike other cross-cutting issues like gender or human rights that has been mainstreamed by the UN for decades now. It seems that climate change is more technical and more knowledge demanding. And so it's important for those of us in the UN who work on conflict prevention and peace building to really get the science right.
But do you feel like the climate scientists feel like they're being listened to at all? Because I know there's a lot of fear that they're not being listened to, that we're nearing the tipping point and it's kind of nothing they do is actually translating into policy.
I have interviewed 40 natural and social scientists from institutions and universities in Africa, in Europe, and in America, and half of them are African scientists. And so I think in response to your question, it really varies. I think people, scientists who have worked as part of the IPCC and have contributed to those processes, I get the sense that they feel that they have become much better at communicating hard science to policymakers. At the same time, speaking to some of the West African scientists who are doing work in the region, they did express, some of them, some concern about which research gets the attention. Of course, there's a process involved in the IPCC that you have to be, it's a peer review mechanism, so that you cannot contribute if you haven't had peer-reviewed publications. And also you have to be recommended by your government. And so you see a bit of a gap in terms of the representation at the IPCC, and very few of the climate scientists are from Africa. So some of the recommendations from the scientists that interviewed, especially those from West Africa, we're talking about the need to combine what we read in the IPCC reports with other data that exist in the region. Data from universities, data from local researchers who might not have published in big journals. The need also to listen to local communities, some of the risk assessments that we've done also, but also to, for governments themselves to collect the local knowledge that exists within a country and use that as a reference and as complementary to other data. And so I think that's, there's a lot of room to connect the dots between different data, and in that sense, make that data more nuanced and more contextual. And in that way, also for us then who work in the UN on these issues, we will get a broader kind of lens to understand the complexity and how it impacts, especially local populations.
Go ahead, Angela.
I just want to, first, I think this is such important work that Ngozi's been doing. I also think it's so interesting because when a real crisis, I mean, we've had other global crises, but a crisis like this, this catastrophe with climate change happens, we really see problems in the way things have been done before. Because this gap between researchers in Africa and contextual knowledge and research that is at a global level and it's recognized at a global level exists in other fields. So we see in the social sciences, in political science, in peace research, in development studies, we see similar gaps. Because what happens, and I think when Ngozi is talking about these journals, for instance, and peer reviews, they're, you know, international journals that are quote unquote quite high impact. And there are ways in which people from the global south are excluded from those processes. It isn't to say that there aren't journals in Africa or in Latin America or in Asia that are also not peer-reviewed journals, but they're not part of global hierarchy around knowledge creation that exists. So there can be a really number of really great researchers who are very knowledgeable in West Africa, but their research isn't trickled up. They're not affiliated to a Western institution. They're therefore not being quoted by journals in the West. They're not, you know, their research may not be as well funded. They, you know, there are a whole bunch of things that happen sort of downstream that create this real gap in knowledge production. And it, what it means is that policymakers also ignore that research. They only have access to or are exposed to research from certain, mainly in it, Western institutions. So we see the same problem in peace building, for example, in peace building research, or, you know, you see these gaps in development studies. And The problem is then, of course, that you do need, as Ngozi has rightly said, different types of knowledge. You need really contextual knowledge. You need knowledge from local communities. You also need to hear the voices and the perspectives and the processes from researchers who might be very, very good scientists and very competitive, but they're competitive in their country and not at the global level. So I think it's so interesting how you see how this problem of knowledge production and knowledge creation is really intensified in its negative impacts when it comes to something like addressing climate change and peace and security. There you see, this is, as Ngozi said earlier, we don't have lots of time to figure out how to do things differently. And we see people are affected by climate change every day, and that there will be some long-term consequences around conflict as a result. But those things are, that's real in a way that this gap is really kind of showing us up for what we needed to be doing a long time ago, which was really creating platforms of knowledge where many different types of knowledge and different perspectives were included and given visibility and access to policymakers.
I'd like to get back a little bit to what you mentioned before. You mentioned that the UN has been working for some time now to integrate other issues, for example, gender, into their peace-building operations. And not only the UN, also other big players in conflict management. So are these lessons that from these previous ways of working, can they be helpful for those who are pushing to integrate knowledge about the environment and climate into peace and security work? Angela?
Yes. So there's been over two decades worth of work in terms of integrating, or what we called mainstreaming, gender into peace and security. And this came out of the WPS, the Women, Peace and Security resolution in 2000, resolution 1325. That's actually just one point in the political history of integration of women, peace and security into peace and security. Over these two decades, what we've really learned is that it's not simply a matter of just adding women and stirring. So it's not simply a matter of numbers. And it's also not simply a matter of technical solutions. So a gender expert can't just walk into a UN peace operation or into a negotiation and just add gender. It's a political thing. So integration starts with political leadership, with executive leadership. Donors have a huge leverage, but it also has to be ownership from all aspects of the process and all players in a process and across a whole institution. I've met a lot of diplomats working at big international or intergovernmental organizations, some of whom will say things that the WPS agenda is just for women, or it's just a donor-driven agenda. And that to me is a sign of failure. And that's what we don't want to do with climate change. So we don't want to make it only something that's driven from the outside of institutions, or driven simply for a constituency that's far away from us, but really to be able to make it something that's really owned by whole institutions. And there I would say there are two assumptions that we make. We make the assumption that people have to do everything all at once. So to do nexus thinking, you have to do food security, you have to do humanitarian action, you have to do peace building, you have to do all these things all at the same time. I think that's overwhelming for people, for policymakers, for practitioners. That's one assumption. And the other assumption is that there's an immediate cause and effect. Because of our very short-term project cycles, 2 years or 5 years, we always think we need to do something today that's going to have an effect in 2 years or 5 years. So we make cause and effect our kind of guiding mantra, and quite short cause and effect. And I think that's an assumption that we should move away from. I think rather focus on trying to be more inclusive of a climate perspective, and trying to give more opportunities for other players and other partners to come in and to engage, so that I, Angela, I'm not alone trying to implement my agenda, and trying to do everything all at once or within a short time frame. But really, I'm incentivized to partner with Ngozi or to partner with Henrik, who might have another perspective, and that we jointly benefit, our programs jointly benefit, with more money, with more resources, or with more time and more recognition for more collaborative work.
I totally agree with Angela that this idea of putting too much on one person, saying now you have to add, you know, you have to have a gender lens, you have to have a human rights lens, you have to have a security lens, all these different things. We have to think this through. At the same time, there's now an initiative to have climate security advisors in many UN offices, the same as we have had gender advisors in many offices. And so it's important now that it doesn't become this process where one person sits with all the information and it becomes a sort of a standalone entity. And that brings me to some of the recommendations that the climate researchers in the interviews I conducted shared with me. One of the things that many of them said is that let's focus on existing structures and mechanisms and build on those. So in the case of my office, we have a UN regional working group on climate change with all the UN entities in the region, IOM, FAO, UNDP, UN Women, and so on. Let's use that platform. We could invite climate scientists and researchers to come to some of our meetings. We could invite them to some of our risk assessments. We can set up a system where we can call on them for information and where we have questions and so on. There's another platform that exists within a regional body, the Economic Community West African States. They have a platform with all the climate advisors in each of the ECOWAS member states. We could use this network. Why couldn't we in the UN be able with ECOWAS to capitalize on this network? So I can see that there are ways in which we can do this so that it doesn't become cumbersome. But at the end of the day, I think one of the questions that has been really sort of haunting me through this research is one of the natural scientists told me that you need to become climate literate. Like in the UN, you need to have a certain literacy of climate change to be able to do this right. And so the question now is, what does that mean? You know, how much climate knowledge do we need? And this is something that I'm thinking through for the final report. And I do see that it's going to take more than just regular trainings or capacity building workshop. We do need to try to understand more of the contextual issues that Angela had mentioned earlier, how climate change impacts different environments. Even within one country, there are specificities, and so you cannot just generalize. And then I think there's a lot of work to look at how climate change impacts women and young people. It's about the Sahel region, which is the driest region and the most impacted, but it's also about the coastal countries that are experiencing flooding, and where each year communities along the shores are forced to relocate to new communities. And so right now they are welcomed. Will they be welcomed in the future? What can we do to prevent, or rather, what can we do to promote a peaceful coexistence among all these communities?
Thank you. And our final question. So it's a little bit depressing to talk about this subject, but as we wrap up, I mean, are there any positive messages or thoughts that you can share? Angela, would you like to go first?
I'm a dark person. I am dark by nature. So I tend to kind of be really comfortable with the dark picture of things, because I think it's important for us to be really aware of the perils and the responsibility that we have. So I welcome this conversation and the research. I think I would take away some very important opportunities, though, that we have. So I think what Ngozi said about conflict prevention and finally learning how to do conflict prevention is a very important opportunity. I'm kind of struck also by the fact that we spend so much millions and billions in peace and security, and we have an enormous burden on humanitarian actors now with the number of refugees in the world. But learning how to think about how people make their living, not just for today, but for generations to come, is ultimate in conflict prevention. It's an ultimate lesson that humanity needs to learn. And I'm not sure we're up for it, but I think this is the opportunity, if there ever was one, for us to actually start putting more resources into that. Not taking away resources from people that need support today, immediately, but really starting to put resources into shoring up livelihoods, supporting the environment, thinking environmentally, in all sectors, not just in an environmental sector or agricultural sector, but actually thinking about these things when you're thinking about political actors and political choices and peace processes. And that's really kitchen table stuff. That's really where people live and how they live and if their children can go to school and if their children can survive. Really important aspects of for us all to really think about.
That's so well said, Angela. I really agree with that. I'm a sunny person. An optimist.
The yin and yang.
Yes, exactly. That's us.
I see in every challenge, I see an opportunity. It's true, the greenhouse gas emissions cause climate change, which leads to global warming and all the climate disasters we see today, and especially since we're talking about West Africa and the Sahel, how the populations are being affected. But, you know, West Africa also has the most sunshine in the world. There are also a lot of natural resources for climate smart agriculture. On top of that, there are enormous resources of bare minerals, which are the minerals that are increasingly being demanded for electric cars, green energy products. And then 60% of the population are young people. They want to see change. They want to see something happen. It can make some change. I think we've seen, you know, globally that the people who are leading the climate action are among young people. So that gives me hope too. And I think there's enormous resilience to climate change. There was one category of scientists I interviewed who said, look, climate change is not really a problem in this region because, especially in the Sahel, you have populations who have experienced changing climate for centuries, and they have always adapted. But part of that, I think, also is a bit glorifying local capacity to adapt and also putting a little bit too much burden, I think, on individuals because it's a sovereign issue. And some of the researchers I interviewed said that at the end of the day, you can get this right, but you need to ensure that that policy really reflects the needs of the local communities and that they need to be part of that process because they are the first responders to these extreme climate events. And so there's a lot to think about, but I said earlier that already I've received those recommendations about the platforms that can be established and these collaborative efforts that you can have within the UN system, with governments, with regional organizations and civil society. And at the end of the day, it's about, you know, our human capacity to make this change. And so I remain optimistic.
Thank you, Angela Ngozi. Thank you for participating and sharing your insights and knowledge from your research. And also thank you for ending on a at least slightly positive or sunny side.
And we'll see who wins.
To our listeners also, I would like to say that on our website, you can find a reading list to go with this episode. And there you can also find previous podcast episodes. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You so much.